Honored members, support staff, SFC, PBO, members of the media, ladies and gentlemen. This is a joint sitting of the standing and select committees on appropriations and finance. So we'll be having presentations from both of them. I'm with Honorable Mashangu, Honorable Masamai, good morning. Honorable Karim is sending his apology. He won't be joining us, but the members from his committee. Any apologies? Darren?
Good morning, co-chairpersons, honorable members, guests. We received one apology, standing committee on appropriations, from Mr. Matafa. Thank you.
Finance. Dr. George, Honorable Heloise, Honorable Buthelezi, Honorable Mabileza, thank you. Honorable Member.
The Deputy President of the EFL, Floyd Shivambu.
Honorable Shivambu. Yes, sir.
Yes, Chair. Select Committee on Finance, Honorable Karim, Senator Paruchi.
Honorable
Karim.
Thank you. Those apologies. Baba.
Thank you, Chairperson. On behalf of the Select Committee on Appropriations, I would also like to register the apology for Mr. Karim. Thank you, Chair.
He has a third one to. Okay, that's fine. Okay. Thank you, honourable members. Those apologies will be noted. That's how we're going to do it. We'll change the agenda a little bit. Will allow the Parliamentary Budget Office to make a presentation for about 40 minutes maximum, and also allow the Financial and Fiscal Commission also to make about 40 minutes maximum presentation. I think the reason it's simple that when we start interacting, you'll find that the issues they sort of intersect and common issues. So that when we deal with the questions and our inputs, we deal with both the FFC and the PBO issues. That's how we're going to continue. So, PBO, introduce yourselves and then you must time yourselves because I'll also be timing you. Okay?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, members. I'm Nelia Orlandi from the PBO. I'll start the presentation and my colleagues will introduce themselves when they do their sections of the presentation. So just as an introduction, you know the PBO has been established to assist members of Parliament, especially the Finance and Appropriations Committees, in implementing the Moneyballs Act. So the presentation today mainly focuses on the budget review, which is a summary of the estimates of national expenditure, the division of revenue, the appropriations bill, and the revenue proposals by the National Treasury. So in terms of the 2020 budget proposals, it's basically to narrow the consolidated deficit. So in this period of slow economic growth, revenue is estimated also to grow slower, and to bring expenditure in line with a slower growing revenue, revenue also has been reduced in the 2020 budget and also over the medium term. The realization of the proposed expenditure reductions are based on several uncertainties. we identify that the actual outcomes of 2019-20 must still realize, which needs to form the basis of the new MTEP. And then public sector wage negotiations has not been concluded, and program reviews feeding into the planning and budgeting cycle. The new cycle of reviews will only start next year. So proper reviews hasn't been done to inform this budget. In terms of critical factors in the planning and budgeting cycle, is to make sure that we align resources with policy priorities. Just to give you two examples, is that one of the priorities are to capacitate government, versus what we see in this budget is a reduction in COE. One of the other priorities that we also just want to mention is that health, education and rural development is a high priority for government and also for the National Development Plan. But we see basically a decline in provincial and local government conditional grants. In terms of the policy priorities, the state of the nation provides the strategic direction for the budget, but we find or we see that the 2020 budget has been based on the pillars of the economic strategy of South Africa, which includes the strengthening of the macroeconomic framework to deliver certainty, transparency, and to lower the borrowing costs. It focuses on spending on education, health, and social development, but also modernizing network industries and restructuring our state-owned enterprises. Government wants to open markets to trade with the rest of the continent, implementing a reimagined industrial strategy and lowering the cost of doing business, focusing on job creation sectors such as agriculture and tourism. It should also be noted that specific priorities that has been identified by the President in the State of the Nation has not been budgeted in this budget because it's still under the planning period of these projects, in specific the new university in Ekurhuleni. Going forward, the budget priorities framework, previously called the mandate paper, is currently under review. And that needs to align to the presidential priorities, the medium-term strategic framework, to ensure the implementation of the National Development Plan. Just to show you the priority spending in terms of the current budget and how it changed since the 2019 budget estimates, you will see the proportions for learning and culture are still the highest proportion of the budget spent on that function group, although it's been declined from 21.2% to 20.5%. Health is now reduced to 11.9% since the previous estimate, and the second highest proportion of the budget is currently spent on social development. The third highest proportion of the budget is currently spent on debt service costs, and for the first time now, debt service costs is basically higher than what we spend on health. My colleague Siraj will continue with the economic section.
Honourable members, Chair, thank you, Nelia. Just to very briefly just remind us of what we presented in the pre-budget. We spoke about the problems in the global economy and we see day to day that the predictions and forecasts for what's going to happen in the global economy are being affected, especially by the COVID-19 coronavirus. And so I think, at least in the first quarter, but this year, there's a high likelihood that we're going to see lower global demand, and that affecting global supply chains, prices for commodities, and having a direct impact on the South African economy. And I think the projections that we saw in the budget review, notwithstanding the fact that they have two scenarios in the budget review, I think even then we will have to re-estimate and rethink. And I think pretty soon we're going to be seeing re-estimates for South Africa. The
The budget review proposes from an economic perspective what we're seeing on the left side of this graph, supply side interventions in answer to the question, where will growth come from? And basically it's saying that if we do certain kinds of reducing the cost of things linked to reducing the cost of business and increasing the reliability of electricity supply through prudent adoption of prudent and fiscal monetary policy, we're going to be seeing growth. And a lot of these things may not happen within the medium term, but they will improve the outlook, and they do talk about some possible upside. But as I said, we're seeing that in the current state of the global economy, and also how that will affect South African growth and domestic demand, that is a huge problem. And so what we've been saying for a while, and we said in the pre-budget presentation we did, and we're repeating it now, is that there is a need to complement what we have and what Treasury is proposing in the budget review with demand side interventions. One is because if you want your supply side interventions to be more effective, you do it in an environment, in a macroeconomic environment that is conducive to growth. Secondly, the problems in the economy are much bigger than just the microeconomic problems identified with microeconomic interventions. They link to mass unemployment and huge inequality. And this has been a long-term problem causing long-term erosion of the social fabric and other problems. And that has to be addressed in the short term and the long term through demand-side interventions. And thirdly, in response to what's happening in the global economy and the possibility that the South African economy will be hit, the one way in which we cushion ourselves from that is through actually saying, well, how do we stimulate rather than through government expenditure rather than cut? So the macroeconomic approach in the 2020 budget review is too narrowly focused on the supply side of the economy. So this brings us to the point of what kind of macroeconomic thinking is being used to guide our policy choices and the kind of budgets that we're doing. And is that the right kind of thinking? And we argue that it's too narrowly focused on the supply side of the economy. It comes from a type of economics where you basically assume that you have rational agents, you assume often that you have full employment, and rational agents are taking optimizing decisions in one point of time to optimize at some future point of time. And that, you know, if there is some kind of external upsetting of that equilibrium, that you have a benevolent central bank that steps in and stabilizes things. Now, from the experience, especially with the global financial crisis, but over long periods of time, we know that isn't enough. And what we do need, we argue, is to look at demand-side interventions and the fact that the economy doesn't follow a predetermined path. There are various paths and the economy can evolve down, and the demand side within the short term and the long term opens up future supply through current demand influencing investment and adding to the capital stock. And within this thinking, you know, we in a world that's uncertain, and the uncertainty, for instance, with the coronavirus and the global financial crisis are two things that bring that point to mind. But also it's path dependent, and also the kind of investments we make are long term. They're not things that we can reverse in the short term. And so we need to take a different look at the kind of economics. Sorry, there's a quote in the National Treasury, in the budget review on page 13, where they say that the foundations of global economic growth include prudent and credible fiscal and monetary policy, reliable electricity supply, a well-functioning financial system, and respect for the rule of law. The speed at which an economy can grow will be determined by the factors affecting the cost of doing business. And what we're saying here is that the speed at which an economy can grow doesn't only depend on the cost of doing business, it depends largely on improving the aggregate demand so that when people with reduced cost of doing business start producing things, there actually are people who can buy those things. They can actually realize the profits and then use those profits to invest more. And so we're arguing that the way in which an economy grows over time is largely determined by aggregate demand, not by the supply side type interventions, but we're saying that we need both, not just supply side as laid out in the budget review. We say that reducing the demand in export and domestic market is also seriously constrained, and so reducing the cost of business is not enough. Governments worldwide now favorably consider fiscal policy to boost demand, and we're seeing more and more in the literature coming out of the IMF, the World Bank, central banks around the world, the Bank for International Settlements, these kinds of arguments. The South African government can make targeted fiscal choices to boost aggregate demand, particularly consumption by poor households and infrastructure systems. The next graph looks at the economic situation, and there's a table which I hope you can all read. I'm just going to focus on the middle column, the 2020. So what this table does, each row gives an estimate from the 2018 budget review, the 2018 medium-term budget policy statement, the 2019 budget review, 2019 medium-term policy statement, and for each year. And this shows how they've changed over time for GDP, household consumption, and investment. Now, as we all know, household consumption and investment are two major parts of the expenditure side, the demand side of GDP. Now, if we just look at 2020, the middle column in each one of these, if you look at 2018 budget review, it was forecast to be 2.1 GDP. If you look at 2019 budget review, it was 1.7. And if you look at the 2020 budget review, it's down to 0.9 from an estimated 0.3% last year. And as I said, given what's happening in the global economy, it will probably be worse than that. But I think what's stark is the point to which the South African government and policymakers have been assuming a certain growth and certain growth path that hasn't been realized, and not actually looking at the threats globally and in terms of domestic demand and the huge impact of low domestic demand, aggregate demand on the economy. If you look at household consumption, I'll just do this. Sorry, I need to end quickly because we've got the limited time. 2020, they were projecting 2.3% growth in household consumption. Now, household consumption, as we've said many times, is almost around 60% of GDP. It's a big contributor to our growth. And if household consumption grows, GDP grows, and we get more revenue, but also our debt-to-GDP ratio comes down because GDP has gone up, for instance. We see that by 2020 budget review, we have to re-estimate that down to 1.3. And again, we worried that we won't reach that. We worried that people have got high-level debt. They managed to reduce their debt since the global financial crisis. But we've seen a switch towards unsecured debt, more credit card debt, and other debt that are more expensive to repay. So even if people have paid down debt, their debt repayments aren't coming down. They're not able to save. They're actually, at the moment, increasing debt again to just meet their day-to-day needs. And here we're talking about people actually have access to debt. Now the third one is investment. 2020, we were looking at 3.7%, a very high level of gross fixed capital formation in the economy for 2020. We saw last year that it had come down to, it had been negative, minus 0.4%. We're seeing the prediction for 2020 in the budget review for 2020 at 0.2%, really low. And this includes, I think, in the modeling, the investment drive of the president and others. So what we want to stress, and what I think this table is showing, is that we need to take aggregate demand seriously. We can't just look at the supply side. Aggregate demand has been an important drag on the economy. The 2020 budget proposed expenditure has cuts of $261 billion, However, it does not point to ways of stimulating growth, investment, and employment adequately over the medium term. It doesn't provide plans for responding to global risks. And within the budget, we don't see debt to GDP coming down. It actually increases over the period. With that, I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Rashad. Thank you, Chair.
As mentioned, I'm Rashad, and I'm taking you through the fiscal framework, at least trying to decompose it, what is presented. Thank you. Our members, this graph shows the significant downward revision to the projections between the two budget reviews. That's Budget Review 2019, the red line on top, and Budget Review 2020, presented last week, the blue line on the bottom. What it shows, and as you're well aware right now, is a significant downward revision to the projections over the medium term between the two budgets. This reflects both significant downward revision to the growth outlook, as well as GDP inflation, as well as revisions to the revenue projections, as well as expenditure adjustments. So that's all in the blue line compared to the red line. Following from the previous slide, what we do over here is we decompose the change. So the change is shown by the red line at the bottom of the screen. So we're seeing a 1.8% increase in the budget deficit compared to what was presented last year, 2.3% in the next year, and 2% over the third year. So these are quite significant revisions, as mentioned. So we know the key factors contributing to the change in the deficit, expenditure revenue, and obviously GDP performance, or the outlook for the economy in terms of GDP growth. What we do over here is we show how each of these factors, each of the main factors, contribute to the change in the budget deficit between the 2 years. Mm-hmm. What's very clear from here is the size of the green blocks. So the green blocks indicate the contribution in terms of the percentage point difference from revenue. So we noted very significant downward revenue projections compared to what was presented 12 months ago, and my colleagues are going to deal with that later on in the slide, but these are very significant revisions. So of the 1.8% increase in the budget deficit that's consolidated between the 2 years, the largest component of that is because of revenue. Now, it's important to note over here, and that's explicit in the budget, as the Minister mentioned, that a specific decision was taken not to pull any further revenue instruments, not to introduce any revenue policy changes, given the weak state of the economy. Consequently, you're seeing large shortfalls or large revisions to the revenue estimate. The next biggest component over here are the orange blocks, and that's expenditure. Now, we note in the first 2 years of our graph over here that the contribution of expenditure to the budget deficit is negative. This, again, reflects policy changes, in particular the decision to, or a policy proposal to reduce expenditure significantly over the medium term. Had that policy change not been proposed, you would have seen a larger contribution and larger budget deficit estimated. And finally, we've got the gray bars, and that's the role of GDP growth, nominal GDP growth over the medium term, and the contribution of that. Our members, we know that government stated fiscal policy as of the past 4 years is to stabilize debt as a share of GDP over the medium term. So that's government stated fiscal policy over the medium term. This graph attempts to assess whether that objective is being realized or not. Now, we note that government was quite explicit in the budget review that debt does not stabilize over the medium term as per their projections presented last week. So that's the blue line you're seeing on that graph over the medium term. However, it's important to not just look purely at the trajectory in and of itself, but rather compare that trajectory to other trajectories. So if we look at the green bar and the yellow bar, so the green bar are PBO's estimates from the beginning of the year, and these don't reflect any policy adjustments, and the yellow bar is what was presented by government at the MTDPS last year. Now, what's important to note over here is the marginal decline in the debt projections compared with PBO's estimates as well as the MTDPS estimates. What that indicates are the fiscal measures proposed in the budget review to attempt a marginal and a progressive realization of debt stabilization over the medium term. And so whilst if you look at the budget review figure 1.1, which shows an exploding debt trajectory path, when we control for GDP, we actually are able to see the measures instituted by government for stabilization. So whilst it doesn't stabilize for sure over the medium term, based on the projections, we have to note the marginal changes relative to a non-policy adjusted path. At the same time, I'd actually like to note over here that had government made proposals to stabilize debt as a share of GDP over the medium term, it would have required additional fiscal effort of 320 billion rands over the medium term. Now, the simple maths over here would indicate that had those measures been instituted, it would have hurt growth particularly badly, given the poor state of the economy, affected households poorly, and also affected the ability of the state to continue service delivery at its already constrained levels right now. So I think that's really important when we're assessing the trajectory over the medium term and the non-realization of this fiscal policy objective. Thank you.
Thank you, colleagues. Good morning, honourable members, colleagues. My name is Dumsan Chanchis. I'll quickly take you through the budget, the revenue discussion there. I think it's very important to mention that the collection of government revenue is an integral part of the budget process because, you know, having this revenue enables government to achieve its objectives set out in the NDP and other strategic documents. So it's very important to understand that. And about 90% of government revenue, considered government revenue, is generated through various taxes, and these taxes largely rely on economic growth, employment and pay rises, corporate profitability, dividends paid, consumption economy, and imports, but also importantly to understand the role of the tax policy in actual collection process in this regard. But I think it is therefore important to realize that these factors, how they affect the collection of revenue collection there. I think in this slide, as Rashad has mentioned earlier on, just trying to show the decline in projections of revenue between 2019 and 2020, and you realize that 2021-22 sees high decline in revenue projections and due to high declines in PIT and VAT, see the red column is for 2022 there. And the aggregate you know, projections, the gross decline projection is 9% on 2022 due to higher declining in personal income tax. And I think, like I said, those initial factors, they play a role in realizing these collections. So declining projection is largely due to economic growth, employment issues and corporate profitability and self-sufficiency according to government. So it's worth understanding how such aspects are important. I think in this light, government noted that the proposals are intended to support economic, the 2021 proposals are intended to support economic recovery, as Rashad was emphasizing there, and largely has major increases in most of the taxes. And you realize by looking at the 2021 projections being quite exactly the same with the projected outcome for the 2019-2020 expected outcome of revenue. Some of the major proposals is increasing the carbon tax rate, which will lead to 1.75 billion increase. And also on plastic levy, which will also increase to 250 million additional revenue in this regard. But I think the bigger effect was also on PIT, where we've seen since a couple of years ago, we've seen adjustment of all tax brackets, which means there will be a bit of a decline in PIT due to the fact that the tax brackets were adjusted for more than inflation, which also means a bit of a relief for some of the low-income households who have a bit lower tax liabilities in this regard. But I think that there are also other proposals which, you know, you see on the side there, which some, you know, are quite more significant, which are more policy shift in how the tax policy will look, particularly in CIT, see restricting offsetting of assessed loss. Because what's been happening, or what SS, the commissioner tried to explain, as was explained last week, that what's been happening, many corporates would use the losses
to set off their tax liability in future years, and that has been restricted in a way to make more space for product tax base for CIT, and also trying to deal with base erosion proficiency by limiting deductions of interest, particularly related to lease party transactions in this regard. So those are some of those measures that I would think they would lead to more revenue in this regard. And the government has is looking to restructure corporate tax, corporate income tax scheme over the medium term by broadening the tax base and reducing the current statutory corporate income tax rate, which is currently sitting at 28. Government knows that the CIT rate sitting at 28% is high and uncompetitive globally. However, I think what we want to emphasize is to also that it is worth noting that cost-effective tax rate, which is the actual tax paid by corporate taxpayers, is actually one of the measures used by investors to also look in terms of how to benefit in investing in a particular jurisdiction, as effective tax rate shows incentives, deductions, and allowances are available for investors. And when you realize in the in terms of literature, some of the discussions we've had before, we realize even though our corporate tax is 28%, our effective tax rate is far much lower than the 28%. I mean, you know, an average below 15%, of course, you know, we can explain that later in this regard. And therefore, the restructuring of the corporate tax system from the oversight perspective should also take into account some of these discussion about effective tax rate and how it affects the whole discussion in this regard. And then the other point, I think during the pre-MGPS pre-budget discussion last week, we did bring up discussion around taxation within the digitalized economies. And I will note that the government is currently working within the OECD inclusive framework in trying to resolve the base erosion and profit shifting issues which are brought about by the digitalized economy. But I think we also noted that, Chair, there has been a lot of discussion which some are seen to be criticizing the current approach by OECD framework in terms of whether it will be really will it be able to implement it, or will it bring more complexity in the system as it is. But I think also listen to developing countries criticizing the mechanism that it will not necessarily favor for them in addressing some of the challenges they have. And we've also seen many countries actually diverging from the discussion within OECD, going more unilateral approach, whereby the even members of the OECD countries themselves creating their own unilateral policies to deal with the digital economy. And I think what the point that we also want to put to members is to also raise the comment with government to hear the view in with regards to the unilateral approach in this in taxing the digitalized economy, more so that we have been losing so much revenue since the WTO moratorium on taxation since 1998 of digitalized products. Thanks. Elia.
Thank you, Lisa. I'll take you through the expenditure slides. So members, just to show you the effect of the reduction in terms of the growth rate of the function groups in the budget. But also to remind you that the function groups in the budget is basically various institutions across the three spheres of government are categorized within different budget function groups, and the categorization is based on the objectives or activities within those institutions. And this was also done by the National Treasury to make sure that we try and, or we align the budget to the National Development Plan. So in terms of the proportions or the growth rates, in the 2019 budget, the growth rate for the Learning and Culture Function Group was estimated to be at 7.6%, but that growth rate over the medium term has now been adjusted to only 4%. You will find that all the function groups basically have been reduced downwards, the growth rates over the medium term, except for debt service costs has now increased to 12.3%. In terms of the trends within the economic classification of the budget, you will see that in terms of current payments, since the 2019 budget, it has been reduced to 59.6% from 60%, and within the current payments is the compensation of employees and goods and services. So the reduction in the compensation of employees, in 2019, government estimated that we're going to spend almost 35% of the budget on COE. It has now been reduced to 32.7%. On the other side, the graph is the same composition, but it's showing the growth rates. The growth rates now for compensation of employees has now been reduced to 3.5% over the 2020 budget, or over the 2020 medium term, which was estimated at 6.8% in the 2019 budget. The last bar there, you can see the payments for capital assets, which also includes the transfers to state-owned companies, that it's still growing by 9.6%. Just to summarize the trends in the expenditure, so what I've showed you now is all the effect of the decline in the budget, or the reduction in the baseline, of 261 billion. So programs were reduced by 101 billion over the medium term, of which the main reductions were in provincial and local government conditional grants. And there was also slight changes on the national level in terms of the goods and services. The compensation of employees' budget over the medium term has reduced by 160 billion. But some of these reductions have been reallocated. So it's not just taking away 261 billion. 111 billion of the 261 has been reallocated, of which 60 billion have been reallocated to state-owned companies. ESCOM is getting an additional 33 billion, and SAA almost an additional 10 billion. And just to inform you a bit more of what's happening in the compensation budget, we are seeing, our analysis is showing that from 2018, actual spending on COE, the increase to 2019 was 7.6%. But the increase from 2019 to 2020 is only 1.5%. So that is actually what's creating some of the questions in terms of whether this is realistic. In terms of the 2020 medium term, the budget for COE is growing by 3.5%. So just to take it a bit further, we've checked the growth rates on the national level of COE. So between 2019 and 20, there's still a growth of 7.2% on a national government level in compensation of employees. And over the medium term, the national COE is growing by 6%. In terms of provincial compensation of employees, it has been reduced, adjusted downwards in the first year by 2.5 billion, in the second year by 2.7 billion, and that is just on a provincial level. And then we went back to see how the expenditure trends in the current year are in provincial governments. And by the end of the second quarter, provincial governments have spent between 4.8% and 50% of the COE budgets. So there isn't much space in the COE budgets at this stage in the current year for the reductions going forward, because the current year will form the basis for the years going forward. What provinces now can do is basically to shift money from goods and services or the infrastructure budgets to make up those losses in terms of COE. And you will find, as I explained just now, it's quite mixed. The trends that you see are quite mixed between different spheres of government. And I'm almost done, members. And we've also looked at compensation in the different function groups. So what I just wanted to indicate to you, you will see compensation of employees in the peace and security function group forms 69% of the budget they spend on COE, and that budget is only growing by 0.9% in the first year of the new medium term. In terms of provincial basic education, provinces spend 51.4% of their basic education budget on COE, and that budget is only growing by 0.5% from this year to next year. Over the medium term, it's a bit higher, but for this year, it might be a challenge. In terms of community development, it's actually a negative growth. The budget for the COE has actually been reduced from this year's budget to next year's budget. We identified a few risks in terms of the current budget, and some of these risks that we're noting is that it's also been acknowledged by the National Treasury. So the first one, we've spoken about it, is the slow economic growth, which also leads to the lower collection of revenue. And outcomes of the renegotiations of the wage bill, insufficient progress in ESCOM, reforms and demands from other financial district state-owned companies is still a risk, and contingent liabilities arising from the road accident fund. The liabilities will increase to 600 billion over the medium term, and is expected to grow by 84% over the 2020 medium term. So this makes the RAF the largest contingent liability for government over the medium term. The Road Accident Beneficial Benefits Scheme Bill has been tabled in Parliament, but it still needs to be processed. Clarity on government's position on the use of pay principle, in specific in terms of the e-tolls. Slow spending on infrastructure might be a challenge, and integrated planning, budgeting, monitoring, and evaluation is still a challenge to ensure effective and efficient expenditure. We're not going to summarize, Honourable Chair. So,
thank you so much, Tim. Finished? Yeah. Thanks. No. Led by example. Well on time. A challenge to Prof and his team, FFC. Honourable members, allow me to recognise the presence of MPS from Gauteng, led by the Chairperson of Finance, Honourable Joe Bisi. Welcome. This Honourable Malima, Honourable Randall, and Honourable Barinos. Thanks so much. Sir, for all yours, the rule, 40 minutes max, sir.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. Honourable Chair, I don't know what happened on my stopwatch. But we're just getting ready quickly, so while we do that, before we start counting, Honourable Chairs, can I introduce the two commissioners that's with me, Professor Trevor Fowler, which many of you know, and Professor Lawrence Erasmus. The two commissioners, you haven't met them because they were appointed last year. With me is the CEO of the FFC, Dr. Kay Brown, who sits behind me, and the Research Director, John Kruger, and the staff of the FFC. What we're going to do in terms of time, I will give a brief introduction, and I'm handing over everything to John so that we maximize the opportunity of the time that's put in. So, I'll go with it. Okay, so I'm going to start now. Chair, thank you very much, honourable members and chairs. Our presentation is trying to show you how we're looking at the unraveling of the gridlock that we find between society, state, market industries, and citizens, and in particular looking at the facilitators and impediments to that gridlock that's actually happening to push economic growth and development, but also social development. We would like to confirm at the point that the OBP, the PBO office has made with regard to some of the factors that compounds that gridlock, the issue of revenues that is pressing, but also the expenditure that is higher than the revenues in terms of the GDP. There are structural changes, and there are disruptions within
the economy and social development, especially as it relates to technological development, both to the domestic economy but also to different market industries. And we think we need to find ways to respond to it. Part of that gridlock is the increasing unemployment, standing at 29.1, but also the slow growth of GDP. In fact, we're in trouble, as we've mentioned to you before. A very interesting story that we will also tell you it's about that gridlock is policy uncertainty. And many a times when we get to Parliament, there's conversations from different people that the uncertainties in policy is because of government. We've got a different story to tell you then, which is quite interesting in terms of how different social movements, social formations, including market industries, has also created and compounded policy uncertainties. We also will talk to you about the need to respond very fast to deal with the climate change issues, population change and migration matters actually happening. But at the long and the short of it, we say while the economy is depressed, we're doing fairly well when it comes to human development index. So there are good stories to tell in terms of this environment we find ourselves in. So with that, I'll hand over to John to take you to the end.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, honourable members. It's always an honour to share ideas with Parliament. I am going to skip through our mandate very quickly. Although it comes from the Constitution also gives guidelines about the factors to take into account in commenting on the DOR and advising. So what we basically do here is look firstly at the economy and society, which is clearly the thing that forms the budget and what is possible, and then secondly at the fiscal framework. In terms of the economy, the budget tells us a fairly well-known story. So the budget tells us a fairly well-known story. We can call it, if we want to, after the Great Recession, the Great Deceleration. South African growth popped up a bit after 2008. Around 3%, and then we've seen that decline over time. Together with that, what we see is this relentless uptick in unemployment from about 22% in 2008 to just under the 30% at this stage. This, of course, is part of the story of what's happening in our public finances. These graphs are the first ones in the budget review. Our gross debt to GDP. The projections have worsened dramatically over this last year, and similarly, our debt service cost as a proportion of main budget revenue increasing from 10 to 18%, and that's of course implications for what we've got to spend on other things. As Professor Plaatjie has indicated, this is not a particularly good story, but we think on other aspects, there are better stories to tell. We are not a society that has done nothing over the last 25 years. The most up-to-date poverty figures we've got are from the National Income Dynamics Study. They show a continuing decline in poverty after the Great Recession, so that our poverty that peaked at 65.7% on the higher income line in 2010 was measured in 2017, the last year the National Income Dynamics Study was done at 52%, and that also goes for the lower income poverty line. In terms of inequality, the story is more mixed. Some people say we have moved sideways since democracy. Some figures show a slight worsening in inequality in the first 10 years, and then a bit of an improvement after that. This is again from the National Income Dynamics Study that followed the same group of South Africans for 10 years. They sort of split us up into classes from the elite at the right to the chronic poor. So the elite are people that live very comfortably, very little risk. They formed in 2017 about 4% of our population. And then there's the chronic poor. Every time, each five times that the researchers went to the people, they were very poor in terms of the measuring line. So there's the chronic poor, there's the transient poor, people that move in and out,
And then there are people that are vulnerable. They've escaped poverty, but they've got very little buffers. And then we've got the middle class. The definition of a middle class is just people with access to overdrafts, to some savings and so on, people who've got buffers that keep them out of poverty. And the story here is that between 2008 and 2007, the number of chronic, the proportion of chronic poor have gone down from 52 to about 42%. So that is no small change. And then the transient poor have stayed about at the same proportion, and those that have been seen going down, we can see distributed in small amounts, increases in the number of vulnerable, the number of the size of the middle class from about 19% to 22%, and the elite from about 4% of the population to 4.9%. So not a static society. A static society where many things are moving and people are moving. Underlying these shifts and poverty and inequality are also the assets of South Africans, the human capital. And we think there's often the story that government has been doing nothing for the last two decades. What we see in two key sectors, in education and in health, is that the outcomes are improving. Here we've got a complex picture. It basically measures how our kids are doing. There are three international tests that are done regularly in South Africa and across the world: the TIMSS, MATH, the PIRLS, and the SACMEC. And we've got them here, the TIMSS, the PIRLS, and the SACMEC. All three of these tests, started in the late 1990s, show that South Africans have increased quite strongly. The researcher who does this, professor at the University of Stellenbosch, says South Africa has been improving at the international speed limit. There are not countries that have improved faster than we have. So one has to grant, we started quite low. For example, we started way behind Botswana, but we've managed to come very close to Botswana in terms of education and outcomes. So there's still a lot of work ahead, and there are many problems in our education system, but the movement has been in the right direction. The second thing is about life expectancy and mortality, and here the SA Media estimates point to us that, you know, our life expectancy has increased from 56.5 to 64.7 over a period since 2002, so an increase of about 10 years. This is that, of course, because of the rollout and the implementation by government of the antiretroviral program. Mostly associated with that is also quite a dramatic decrease in our infant mortality and our child mortality rates. So what we've got here is a situation where the economy is not doing well. Our citizens, in terms of average income, is not doing well. But we have seen improvements in poverty and health, and they have worked through to the South Africans. So in terms of the assets of South Africans, there's been movement in the right direction. In terms of prospects then, our colleagues from the Parliamentary Budget Office has touched on this in much more detail, but there are big risks in the international environment, the trade environment, the coronavirus impacting on our biggest trade partner. Those all affects investor sentiment about developing countries and so on. So the international environment becoming a bit more threatening. We say no real green shoots in the local environment. There are no things that say, well, this sector is going to boom, consumption expenditure, investment expenditure. People are not becoming more confident. So in the economic situation, you know, there are big risks and uncertainties. What we just been in line with the foregoing want to point out is that some of South Africa's investments have been paying off. We are impatient people, so it has not been paying off quickly enough for us, but it has been changing on basic incomes and life expectancy. And as we consider our budget options, it is very important that we must guard these gains. You know, South Africans have often been slapped back by governments, and the big thing is that South Africans have been standing up. If we look at life expectancy, we look at education, and it is about not reversing those gains, doing whatever we can not to reverse those gains. Because they, in the end, the things that bring development. There's a lot of talk about it's the economy stupid, but people drive an economy, people that are healthy, people that are educated. So the
The government's strategy in this context has really got three legs, as our colleagues have also pointed out. So the government says to confront this in the budget, we need stable macroeconomic policy and fiscal consolidation, we need structural change, and we need a capable developmental state. And there's a lot of things being mentioned under structural change, which is basically the transformation paper part of it. If we look there, it's about network industries, competition, boosting exports, and the labor-intensive sectors. Education is also mentioned there. And then also a regulatory efficiency, and that relates quite a lot to our network industries. And then, as Professor Plaatje has also indicated, under this capable developmental and efficient state, this issue of policy certainty and also the capability of the state to implement policy comes up quite often. So we'll come back to the fiscal consolidation in the next section, but just to talk about government's budget strategy, some FFC perspectives on this strategy. In the first place, you know, around policy uncertainty and implementation, I think South Africans are quite critical of its government and policy uncertainty. What the FFC is saying is, you know, policy uncertainty comes from somewhere. It is not just because our leaders are not as clever as those in other countries who are civil servants, don't do their work. Policy uncertainty comes from the balance of power between winners and losers in a society. So a policy is positive for some people, it might not be positive for other people, and people resist. So people who lose have got the ability to block, what we think we see in South Africa is a lot of these cases. You know, parliamentarians will have more examples because you see all the legislation coming across, but spectrum licensing, digital transition, e-tolls, the battle between tax meter taxis and Uber, those are all policy problems that we are really stuck with. And it's really about interest, the interest of the meter taxi driver versus the Uber driver. And so what we are saying here is that as we move forward, we have to be more alert to these conflicts between South Africa. And really the job of Parliament and of government is to try and resolve these conflicts so that we can build what is a stakeholder society where everybody, where there are not too many losers from change. Some societies, like the Nordic countries, build the stakeholder society on social protection so that if you're going to be negatively affected, there will be a good unemployment insurance and a retraining system. So you don't have to fear for your kids when there's economic change. The sovereign wealth fund that the President has mentioned is also a mechanism that societies use for this, so that part of what we get from our assets, we put in a sovereign wealth fund that we can invest back in our society. You know, the FFC hasn't got specific proposals here, but think that thinking around social protection and a sovereign wealth fund is a discussion that Parliament and society must have. The second thing, there's a lot about discussion about structural change in the IMF and in the Treasury. What we think, what we don't see enough of, and at least there in the revenue chapter and so on, but is that we've got these big drivers, climate change, we've got very rapid technological change, population and power shifts, as Professor Plaatje has indicated, and it's really important that our society positions ourselves to minimize the costs and benefits from this. So South Africans will be affected by climate change, and we have to look forward, and these are the real structural drivers we should focus on. We also, you know, both from the IMF and the Treasury and the economists, we get a long list of structural factors. You know, they complain about a government without capacity, but then give us a huge list of reforms. And what the FFC is saying, that we might need better focus here, that we might have to start with what we call a moderate policy, a phased approach, where we start with small things, fixing small things in government, and they will have positive ripple effects. And there we support very much in the budget the limited additional support for the Director of Public Prosecutions, for SARS. Those are basic institutions. As they work better, it will affect the whole of society. There's also on sectoral focus. Parliamentarians will see in the documents a lot of different things are mentioned. the FFC feels that we might have to focus a bit more narrowly and come, you know, become a bit more focused on particular industries that can be growth industries. On government capacity, you know, what we also say here just is that there are deep underlying things here that we must look at. The structure of government, we were hoping that there would be strong positive movements there, but in the end, the reorganization didn't affect much. Governments sit also on systems, and I mean, partly the fact that we've got budget reviews and that we can talk sensibly about the budget shows that there are systems in government, but our sense is that there's attention, it needs attention to strengthen those systems and modernize them. The third thing that often affects capacity in government is not that there's capacity, but that those, that there are overlapping powers and people impact on each other. So we think the whole issue of a clear allocation of functions is an important thing. In concluding this section on the economy, the point is that also that inequality remains exceptionally high in South Africa, probably the highest in the world, and that influences a range of other factors. Social cohesion, one could go on and on here, but it affects social cohesion, the togetherness of people, and it affects people's respect for the rules of the game. So what we are trying to say here is, some people say, first look at the economy, then you look at inequality when you've got the money. Unfortunately, it can't work like that because this inequality destabilizes the economy. So we have to move together, somehow in tandem, working on these things. So those are the broad issues coming then to the fiscal framework. This is just one presentative way of presenting this fiscal framework, and the next slide does it in more conventional terms. So we've got a GDP in 2019. We had a GDP of about 5.2 billion. Government expenditure came to 35.7% of that, 1.8 billion. And then government revenue came to 1.5 billion. So we've got that deficit in 2019-20 coming to, as the PBO has pointed out, 6.3%. And that, over time, that debt has the impact, deficit has the impact on the debt. So in 2019-20, our debt was at about 3 trillion rand and about 62% of our GDP. Now, the things that we think one sees from this framework is basically four things. Is we see a rapid weakening. I've put for you here the 2018-19 figures. So expenditure has gone from 33% to 36%. Revenue has stayed at 29%. But the rapid weakening and the deficit that's been pointed out from 4% in the previous year to 6.3%, and then that escalation of the debt from 56 to 61.7%. So there's been this rapid weakening, there's been a bit of a tipping point, it seems, and now it becomes very difficult to turn this situation around because you've got this rapid expansion, so even with the measures Treasury or government is putting in place, the expenditure stabilized a bit, the revenue stabilized a bit at 29%, but the deficit remains high for the next 3 years at 5.7%, and the debt continues to grow. So where we are at this stage is this rapid weakening, difficulty of turning around. So, I mean, the Commission is with the Treasury, is that something needs to be done about this situation. The other thing that one can talk about on this slide is the comparative picture. So how high are our rates? The Treasury in their revenue, or our ratios, the Treasury in their revenue chapter argues that our tax to GDP ratios are high compared to other middle income countries, and also our corporate taxes in other countries is going down. I think there's a bit about a debate where we lie in the middle of the distribution or a bit to the left. The other thing that is above doubt, though, is that this situation weakens the composition of our spend. Our debt service cost goes up, takes more of the budget. that we rather want to invest. So there is a problem there. And clearly also in an international environment where we are closely looked at by rating agencies, by other governments and so on, this rapid acceleration of our debt impacts on perceptions, conceptions, and the end on our cost of borrowing and investment. So the basic thrust here is that we need to address this urgently. So this is just this slide, just sort of it shows the information in table form. So what does government propose to be done? Government says no tax increases. In fact, we adjusted for inflation so that the burden on citizens will stay in real terms more or less the same. The argument here, as I said before, is that tax rates are comparatively high in South Africa. That Treasury documentation states that increased taxes may hurt short-run economic recovery. We need people to spend to invest, and if we tax them, then that will go down. And then there's also been a long-standing argument that, you know, we might be at the level where we've increased tax rates further, but we might not bring in more. So that's the argumentation on that. So the government focuses on cutting back expenditure, and cutting back expenditure is a phrase that we should use carefully. Really what government is doing is reducing the baselines over the MTF. So what we're reducing allocations compared to what they were in the 2019 budget. So allocations to departments reduced by 101 billion and the baseline wage bill estimates took by 160 billion. And the strategy then here, get the fiscal consolidation going, you've got a return of confidence which will contain borrowing costs and investments will turn us around. And Treasury then also points out here the impact on the composition of revenue and also on expenditure. So if I can briefly go to the expenditure side. So the slide on the left looks at the baseline cuts. So what we actually see for 2021 is that the national departments get an extra 25 billion compared to the previous budget, while provinces and local go down, 21, 22 all go down. And that 24 billion really because of the need to support our state-owned entities. The trends in the division of revenue, so as you see with this big spike in the light blue line, the national trend is a bit, this is the growth rate, so the national share growth shoots up and then comes down to below zero. So firstly helping Eskom and SAA and then moderating the expenditure. And this is why I said also cutting we should be used in a careful way, because if we look at the line for provinces and local government, they run at about 2% growth per year in real terms. So provincial and local government allocations continue to grow in real terms. It's distributed a bit differently, but there is still some growth. On the spending by function, how is this distributed? The Parliamentary Budget Office has spoken about, on the left with learning and culture and health, we see that turnaround. Those were the functions that were growing the fastest. They are reducing dramatically. In the middle, we see social development, community development, economic development is still having some serious growth. And a problem, depending on how you look at it, or a good thing, is that right at the end, peace and security, which is defense, police, corrections, justice, going down by 2.2% per year over the next 3 years. And also the general public services, the National Treasury, the SARS, and those organizations also going down in real terms. So there is, in this budget, real pain, and that then depends how big that pain will be on the outcome of the wage settlement. There's little change in the structure of the revenue. As we said, Treasury indicated, or government indicated, that they don't think that there's room for increases there. There are also some other important revenue initiatives. There's, of course, the strengthening of SARS. The budget gives 1 billion for infrastructure support for SARS. There's also proposals around legislative change to improve governance. There's a big emphasis on broadening the tax base by eliminating incentives and deductions, making the whole situation more effective. And then two things where we think relate to these big drivers, and the Parliamentary Budget Office has referred to that extensively in their previous submission. This digital economy that's grown, that's in a sense undertaxed, and you know, discussions, deliberations in the OECD has been going on for a long time, but countries are losing money in the meantime, and some say developing countries are taking the major brunt of this because the head offices are not here. And then Treasury also announces a discussion paper on environmental fiscal reform that the FFC strongly supports. Coming to the conclusions, the FFC considerations here. So clearly the key part of the government's budget strategy is reducing the growth of the wage bill. The wage bill, I think, estimated to decline by about 0.5% over the MTEF. And there are three questions here that everybody's asking. Can the wage agreement be successfully renegotiated? If we struggle to do that, if that takes a long time and there's conflict, it can create more instability. So there are dangers on that side. Always with these efforts to contain wage bills is the issue of can it be effectively implemented, or will we just see that the best teachers, the best nurses leave for other countries where people don't bicker about a percent here when they work hard, or so on. So there are always unintended consequences from trying to constrain wages as well. Third question, is the strategy fair to civil servants? Of course, this is not myself and my colleagues, who everybody sees as Pretoria bureaucrats earning too much. This is really about nurses, teachers, the police, the prosecutors, the people that we want to keep at this capable state going. And I mean, here these are complex issues. Have public sector wages outstripped private sector wages significantly so that public servants have gained unduly? You know, there are some data from the Reserve Bank and analysts from the Reserve Bank that says, well, actually the public sector follows the private sector. So, you know, we'll have to talk as a society about this fairness, and the question then what we ask here, are there not alternatives for structuring the cost of consolidation? Shifting the attention from civil servants only also to broader society, and, you know, this sounds like one of those areas where a real social pact is possible. We need $60 billion. Do we want to put 160 of that on civil servants? Clearly, what is a concern going forward, and that relates a bit to the demand strategy, or boosting demand, is, you know, has the civil service got the capacity to spend money well? If we go and borrow it, it costs us money, we have to pay interest. Will the civil service use that money well? And we think the negativity is perhaps a bit overstated, but there needs to be work on that side. The last thing that we conclude about, and that you know, is that the fiscal framework as we presented is a drive set of financial ratios, but it is more than that. It shows very fundamentally what choices society make. And we think, you know, there is a revenue future that we must look at. We must ensure that we've got a handle on how technological change produces new assets and new businesses, such as in the digital economy, and that we make sure that we use also those income streams to support South Africans. And then lastly, there are also choices on our expenditure future. You know, how much solidarity, care and mobility in your society, you have in your society, shows in your budget. So societies have got to have a lot of inequality, less social mobility, less solidarity, have low expenditure to GDP ratios. Societies where people have more solidarity, but less inequality, more mobility, have high tax and expenditure to GDP ratios. In a sense, this is a choice South Africans will have to make of what we want our society to look like.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Chairs. I'm handing back to you with 8 minutes. To show efficiency.
No, thank you. They've done very well. All members, we are 4 committees here. And as I said, also all members from provincial legislatures. So I want to try and give everybody an opportunity to, everybody wants to say something, an opportunity to say something. Why I'm saying this is that this is the economic, we are dealing with economic issues here, the economic with time. Right? And I was just thinking that perhaps if I were to say, limit yourself to 2 questions or 2 comments, but I don't want to say that. Right? Can you try to, if I see that people are not able to do that, I think we'll have, I'll have to consult with my fellow chairs here and see how we come, how we come up with more austerity measures to make sure that we confine ourselves to time. I'll then be saying 1, 2, 3, and please just know that you are number 1 or number 2, and immediately number 1 finishes, number 2 you need to come in. I won't be saying come in. If we skip you, we won't have another time. So it's a plea that we are making. Be considerate of other honorable members, otherwise there may be other members who may end up not saying anything, which will be very undemocratic in a democratic country. Okay, we'll start. Let's see by the show of hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We are 5. Yes. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay, that's 12. Okay. Let's see how we fit in. Okay, you are our number 5. So that I don't confuse. I meant you had a stop at a back line. So we are number 13. Okay. So let's see how if we still have got time, we'll take a second round. Okay, let's go.
Okay, Chair, thank you so much. The presentations are truly appreciated. And we appreciate the fact that even before the budget, TPO was here to take us through.
Sorry, Honourable Member, can just a second, just hold. If you don't mind, do say that who are you directing your question to? Is it FFC or TPO?
Thank you, Chair. Maybe just to appreciate FFC for coming up with another way of making us feel good about the budget, you know, and not just feel good, but realize that the budget necessarily does not reside in Treasury. So all stakeholders have a role, and I think it's a call to the public out there to ensure that in whatever department, in whatever corner we are in, we have a responsibility towards the budget. Chair, I think my first question would go to PVO in terms of the MTSF. The question is whether it has already been published, and if no, what then are the implications of the budgeting process? And maybe to both the PBO and FFC Chair, the PBO mentions this on page 8 on the fiscal framework. Whether it has provided enough demand-side intervention. That is the fiscal thing. We are talking towards stimulation of growth. Chair, the last one, maybe also to both of them, what are the other countries doing right that you are not, that we, when it comes to demand-side interventions? Because we're going down while they're going up. So what is it? What are the recommendations that they could serve for us as a country? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. I will contain myself to two questions. The first question is to the PBO with regards to the expenditure trends and the effects of adjustments. Reading between the lines on your presentation, it's clear that the civil service budget is being cut to bail out SOEs, which presents a moral problem in my mind on this. But I'd like to find out if they've done any analysis over the last decade of the population size compared to the civil service ratio, particularly in frontline services of nurses, teachers, doctors, etc., and if it is worth bailing out state-owned enterprises by reprioritizing this budget over hiring additional teachers, nurses, and doctors to deliver frontline services. And then both the PBO and the FFC mentioned digital taxes. And so it's a question to both. But we already make companies pay corporate income tax, and we've introduced a VAT onto digital products, so they do pay value-added tax. What additional taxes are you seeming to suggest, Jim? Trying to understand how this would be from any other kind of business that pays both corporate income tax and value-added tax in South Africa. What additional taxes are they meant to be paying, and would that not be punitively unfair to any digital firm? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairpersons, and also appreciations for the presentations. First of all, I'll go at the PBO, please. I want to talk specifically to your slide on risks. And obviously the risks are real. Most of us know what they are. This is what's going to impact the already too high 6.8% budget deficit. And I'm actually making that 6.8 look unrealistic based on the fact that we're already seeing that the growth projections are outdated. We're already seeing resistance to the wage agreements. And I think that the big concern I have is the trust with government. And of course, we repeatedly hear these issues come up. So now we've got one of your risks, insufficient progress on Eskom. We've got a CRO, the Chief Restructuring Officer, that was appointed, who's completed a report, but it hasn't been published yet. That's being sat on. There's no information coming out. There's the whole issue of e-tolls, where we've been promised, we've been given deadlines and promised that, you know, Razmataz is going to give us a final solution and all of those nice things. Those deadlines come and go repeatedly, and there's no result. Broadband, the release of broadband has been discussed for over 10 years. Now the latest whisper that I heard at the airport yesterday is that government is intending on starting its own broadband company and then becoming player and referee in the same market again. And that this is one of the proposals which is going to undermine the value that is unlocked by those auctions. And what I'm pointing to is integrity. The integrity and the trust in the government is no longer there. And so I think that we actually need to see a lot more coming out of the finance minister in terms of actual specific outcomes, specific comments, dates with deadlines. And I do want to hear from the PBO, please. In terms of projections going forward, 6.8%, we're already pointing to a problem with our debt. We can't take on any more. What are the other options that are open to the finance minister? Because I think he kind of put all of his eggs in one basket in his current speech. Second question is to the FFC, and again, top-class presentation. I've learned a lot just by sitting through it, so I want to appreciate that. As important as what is being said, and there are a number of things that I'd like to interrogate, but obviously due to time constraints, we're not going to go into now. But perhaps, Prof, this question is directed at you. This book, nicely bound, big expense, big recommendations in it, and it's been ignored. You yourself went through a very frustrating time in one of our meetings recently and said that you're not happy with the way that Treasury is interacting with you and the disregard for the proposals of the FFC in spite of the constitutional obligations placed on Treasury to apply their minds to your recommendations. Instead of following the recommendations in terms of local government that you've placed out here, they've done the opposite. They've reduced a lot of the grants and funding that's going to local government. And I would like to hear from the FFC about your behind-the-scenes discussions with Treasury. Are you feeling better than you felt the last time when you were so frustrated? And if there were good reasons given to you for not following your inputs that are so nicely contained in this beautifully bound document, perhaps you could share those with us, please.
Hello, good morning. Thank you, Chairperson, members. The Minister of Finance have outlined the economic situation and the challenges of the country. And now I want to bring it to the ordinary person in terms of the tax reductions for the households. And for somebody to understand as to what does that mean in terms of tax reductions versus the economic situation of the country and also the economic growth. So that what is the impact on the announcement of the minister, so that the ordinary person to understand what that does mean in terms of the whole situation. Then secondly is that if we look in terms of currently the new developments around the coronavirus, and as the Department of Health in terms of its readiness for the coronavirus, in terms of the PBO as an advisory to the committees, what impact will this have immediately on the budget? So that one also understands as to what the situation will be. Then to the commission is that in terms of the prospects around the risk, what will be the impact on the turnaround? Because in terms of the turnaround of the economy, with all the risks that you have listed, how will that have an impact on terms of the turnaround of the economy? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President.
The first one goes to PPO. And the second one will be going to both PPO and MFC.
Chair, the slide
20 and slide 21, PPO, where you are talking on the expenditure trends. Slide 20, focusing on the budget function group, and the second one, research on reductions on economic classification. Chair, how do these reductions talk to the expenditure trends of the last MTF, say the last year, particular reference to the capacity to spend? I've read that, Chairperson, and I see that there isn't much spoken to about the figures that were taken back to the treasury cash due to non-spending. If that could be, you know, also reflected. So that before we cry foul on the reductions, let's see if the real figures allocated were actually spent. Lest you would be crying foul to find that we have been borrowing money which has been used only to escalate the debt on the other side. The second one, Chair, goes to both PPO and NSC. It relates to my last, word, debt. On the debt GDP ratio, I've seen you have spoken, both of you, on the debt, and also you've spoken on the growth. But now I'm deliberately lame when it comes to this one. Is this particular budget focusing more on reducing the debt, or is it focusing more on increasing growth? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks so much, Chairperson. My question is directed to both the PPO and the FFC. Yeah. So, when looking at slide number 24, I'm very covered with the questions that were raised by the FFC. Really, in South Africa, the collapse of the economy that is caused by corruption, fraud, leaching, state capture, and all those things. The inability of the current government to lead end up causing problems in the civil service. The reducing of the wage bill is my concern. What is the approach that the government is going to use? Are they going to cap the adjustment on their salary? What are they going to do? Because we are seeing the economy is collapsing. How are these people going to survive going forward if we resort in reducing their wage bills because of the diligence of the government to run? The other thing is, on the FSC, we talk about this, even though the economy is doing bad, there are certain things that we did better, like the poverty is reducing and all those things. What is the barometer that you are using? Because to us, everything is collapsing. The state, the health system is collapsing, the education system, everything in South Africa under the ruling government is collapsing. But your presentation is talking positive about those things. Please give us a response on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My first question is going to be directed to FFC. You have spoken about broadening tax base and eliminating incentives. Now, given the appalling state of employment in South Africa and the fact that young people bear the brunt of unemployment more than any population cohort in the country, I would want to know, how effective do you think the employment tax incentive scheme has been? Do you think it has been able to stimulate economic growth, and do you think it has been able to create sufficient employment opportunities for young people? The second question is going to be directed towards PBO. In 2018-2019, there were growth projections for investment. Now, my little understanding is that those projections would have been based on a pipeline of investment projects. Now, we do not see visible numbers of these projects in the economic growth numbers of the previous year. Three, given the reality that, and this is for both, given the reality that the global economy is facing numerous headwinds, there is a greater need for us to focus on the domestic economy. I would want to know whether you believe that this budget will be able to stimulate domestic demand. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. My question, the first one is probably to both the FFC and PBO, but I need to start by joining my colleagues in appreciating the presentations, and they are really informative and they help us to understand the budget process even better. I just want to find out, in particular from PBO, if the Parliament's oversight mechanism delivering results. In short, I'm asking, are we as MPs effective? You would remember that we've got this 40 triple or more, triple B, R, is it triple B, whatever, but the B and the R reports. We've got the committee reports. Do you think that whatever comes from those processes and the reports that were tabled in Parliament, that were adopted by Parliament, have they been factored into the budget? But also, does the parliamentary committees have the capacity to make sure that they can track their previous decisions and how they impact on the allocations and the rendering of services? The other question is to the FFC. No, let me go again to the one. Yeah, FFC. You make reference to the National Income Dynamic Study, especially with reference to work done by all those studies or those institutions or institutes that did studies on inequality and poverty. There's an indication that South Africa, or 72% of South Africans, are in the category of the chronic poor. And that we see on a daily basis. Our people scavenging from landfill sites to be able to get food that has been actually discarded from the retail sector and dumped, which is a health risk. Secondly, they also scavenge there for any material that they can then go and sell for recycling to have any income. That in itself tells you, you don't have to search anywhere, it tells you that we've got a serious problem of poverty. But is the FFC saying to us that all these interventions by government and different programs and policies, that they are not bearing fruit? If you look at the reconstruction and development program, the interventions that were done with creating a better life for all, as well as the programs on the war on poverty, which was run from the presidency for many years through the office of the deputy president, are you saying we are unable to really get to the bottom of the challenges of the poverty that our people live in? You know, every day you see, you don't have to read, you see the pain in the face of our people, especially those who live in informal settlements. Others are even living under plastics, despite the fact that there is the free the RDP houses, free basic electricity, free basic water, and all that. What is it? What has the FFC, through engagements with these institutions, been able to pick up? Because we cannot forever be told that the Gini coefficient indicates that we are the most unequal society in the world. How come? Is it because our information is out there for everybody to see? Or is there just something that we don't we are not able to pick up? And I'm also raising this PBO. Are we not able, as these committees of parliament, to pick up these people that are actually slipping through the cracks? Is our petitioning systems and all those from our constituencies able to make it possible that we can then intervene and create this thing? But also, have we, as this committee, been effective in engaging our counterparts in other committees? I'm sure if we did that, the PBO would definitely have the information. The other thing, in conclusion, Chairperson, as a Christian, they say God does things for different reasons, and some things happens for a reason. We are sitting here today as this appropriations, finance, select committee, finance, It's what are we saying? If you look at 25 or more now, depending on whether others have been found or not, of our most vulnerable aged people, who because of lack of access to certain basic amenities, had to travel in a bus in the conditions of the roads that are so unfriendly. You know, Jefferson, that KZN, Eastern Cape, Limpopo, and other parts like Northwest have got the most difficult roads to navigate. How do we then say, Jefferson, through your, through you to FFC, and because the FFC is the one that has, needs to help us to be able to make sure that resources follow. We've got these communities, and you say to them that resources for Treasury takes a decision for non-toll roads to go to e-toll. And if you look at the transport subsidies in this country or funding for transportation in this country, the rural communities bear the brunt of not being adequately supported. I once read an article of a woman who was raped, and on her way to reporting the rape which to a police station which was about 200 kilos away, she was raped by the person who gave her a lift again. So it tells you that, truly speaking, if you talk about inequality, we live through it, we see it daily. How do we make it possible, and how do we explain to our people as MPs that we have to take from the Passenger Rail Agency of South Africa to fund SAA and ESCOM? Understandably so for ESCOM, that we need those resources to make sure that there is electrification. But equally so, in the same budget, we take a decision to reduce the, not we, government takes a decision to reduce the Integrated National Electrification Program budget, which means that the numbers as extrapolated by the NDP on when we are going to meet the target for electrification is getting more and more reduced. So I'm just saying, FFC, I know that you have said that you have not listened to in the past, but what is it? I don't want you to take the approach of Step SA, but what is it that can be done by a committee of this nature to help make it possible that our interventions, and I'm happy last week in this very house, Jefferson, in the old Assembly Chamber, the President spoke to traditional leaders when he opened the House of Traditional Leaders. He said that the traditional leaders must help government stem the tide of the migration to the urban centers, because it is these people who migrate to urban centers who are living in squalor, because they've got houses in the rural areas. And how do they do that when the resources are not following them where they are to make sure that our people can be able to stay where they are? Thank you, Jefferson.
Thank you, Chair. I'll keep it brief. FFC, thank you for the presentation. I'm referring to slide 9 that speaks to inequality. I want to know, what effect does population growth have in inequality, keeping in mind that grants form part of the income, so to say, of the very poor? Is there any correlation in population growth with regards to inequality? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Now, Chair, before I ask the questions, which I welcome the two reports from PBO and FFC, I think, Chair, I need to raise the following, Chair, with your permission, that I think there's a lot of assumptions made in the public discourse about the ruling party not being able to lead the country towards prosperity. And I don't think it's true, because I think from where I come from,
I know for a fact that the ruling party is trying to change the lives of South Africans, despite the fact that there are challenges here and there, but I think it is. Of course, the difficult economic situations, the difficult situations, Honourable Chair, will definitely...
Sorry, point of order.
No, I think the speaker now is debating. We are not debating. I mean, we are not arguing. He must raise his point and they will report, yeah.
That's fine, Honourable Member. Let's allow the member to make his input.
I think, we come from provinces, so we have the autonomy of engaging.
Before you continue, Honourable Dick, I think this thing must go both ways. Be careful of what you say. If you say things that will trigger debates in a wrong platform, you will get debates. And such things, they have a platform in the House where we can be political about things. So it's going to be difficult to control members to debate on issues, because issues that are raised here are for committee and are for processing. And if clarity is needed, because you need, sometimes they will like to support you and they don't have an understanding, or they want to lobby other members to have a different view from what you have put on the table. So let's just try to work as a team and not politicize the committee, because we have a platform where we can throw stones at each other.
No, Chairperson, we're not politicizing issues. Reality is reality, and we are not going to run away from reality. The truth is the truth. So what we are speaking here is the truth. So, but you can carry on and debate, we'll debate further. No problem.
Or remember, I don't want us to spend a lot of time. All of us. Yeah, I think let's allow our members to speak. As I said, that people have got limited time.
I'll be brief, Chair.
But Chair, on record, let it be corrected. Can't just go uncontested.
Can I ask all of you? Let's continue. I don't want us to spend a lot of time on this. Can I allow members to speak? People have an opportunity to speak and so on. Can you please continue?
Thank you, Chair. Now, Chair, you see, when you raise the political questions, politicians will respond to it. Because in the committee, I know that we don't have to debate and argue about political matters, which I think you guys have to deal as honourable members in the House. But let me leave it at that, but it was worth responding to. On the FFC presentation, which I think it has highlighted many things that I think will help us going forward as well. But I haven't had the presentation touching the difficulty of the public sector wage bill, which is currently beginning to create problems in our country if some of these issues are not being addressed. On the slow spending on infrastructure, also the implications thereof, because we know that in 2019-20 financial year, there's been that cry that we supposed to have done a lot in terms of delivering infrastructure to our people. And last week when we were with the minister, we were told that a lot of the grants, infrastructure grants, amounts given to us in provinces in particular, would then have to go back because of lack of spending. I think if you could also look at that. I think on the issue of ETOL, my colleague has asked that, Honourable Ryder, that the implication as a risk of not pronouncing this issue of the ETOL, because we have been told that the Premier, the ministers will pronounce on this particular matter, and that hasn't been done up to this far. What will be the implication of not announcing this in the current issue? On the PBO, I think the one or two issues that I think I need to raise is the conditions. Look, we're bailing out SAA and giving ESCOM more money. What are the conditions given to this particular grant, to this particular two institutions? Because we haven't had, and we tried to probe last week with the minister and we couldn't get a favorable response on the matter. Lastly, Chair, is the issue of the provinces to shift money from the goods and services to make sure that we compensate on the employees' compensation. I think it's something that worries me, because we have seen the trend, particularly on the fourth quarter, where monies are shifted into other programs, and I think that creates another issue. What will be the implications of this? Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairperson. And let's also welcome the presentations by both the BPO and the FFC. Chairperson, one would raise this concern, and it should be recorded that this budget seems to be focusing more on the debt reduction than ongoing the economy of the country. And I think maybe both the FFC and PBO may advise in that regard, but that is a call for concern. Again, Chairperson, maybe if you can maybe be provided with the previous parliament or oversight decisions that were taken by both committees, so that you can maybe be informed of how many have been implemented or whether those have borne any results. If they have, we may have an indication of whether we are making progress or not. And equally, Chairperson, one would ask the PBO to what capacity does this committees have in terms of assisting in whatever way that in whatever they were raised, because we would be seen to have. To be having meetings, to be deliberating, but the one would say the teeth is seen to be very minimal. So maybe if you can be advised as to how far can we go in that regard. For now, let me pause. Thank you very much, Chair.
Chairperson, I thought I'm not going to speak, but let me take this opportunity to welcome the both presentations from PBO and FFC. And I think we all have this understanding that the two institutions are here to assist us and empower us as the committee, so that we can be able to better analyze the budget. And when we take decisions, we're well informed. And I like what you just said, Honorable Member. And this is a question that we have always been coming to you about. The extent of the power that we have. And I think we have also said as a committee to say we need to come up with a tracking mechanism so that we don't just take resolutions or recommendations to the House, and then these resolutions we depend on the leadership or the executive of the House, two houses, to make tracking on the resolutions. How far are we? Fortunately, the Appropriations Committee from National Council of Provinces. We have tried to make that tracking, and it is so disappointing that from FFC we haven't received, because I expected to receive from you, Prof. And we haven't received any response. PBO, I don't know if you were part of the people that we have returned to. We have only received response from Treasury on the conditions. And we're still trying to figure out how are we going to process this. And if conditions were sent to us, Honorable Chair, we'll have to share it with you so that we together monitor. But going forward, I think we should learn from the mistakes that we might have done previously, because we all want what is better for the country. To highlight on this issue of the conditions of road, which was raised by Honorable Peters, I think she forgot to include Limpopo and Mpumalanga, the rural roads. I know you're laughing, you think I'm going to say something, I'm not going to say it. But you know, so the rural provinces, they are really disadvantaged on that. So I think as we give advices and strategies on how to tackle these things, we need to be advised on that. The budget is focusing, because we are made to understand that this administration is prioritizing the poor, and the poor of the poorest are, and the disadvantaged are still in the rural provinces, rural areas. So we need to take care of that. The issue of the barometer, I think on the because it came to me last time we said, I don't know if it's FFC to say or is it PBO, to say when you present, please indicate the source, so that when we go back and analyze these things, we can also have a direction on what source. But I've seen the graphs you have given different years, so you can at least, if you have a little bit of understanding in economy or statistics, you can be able to read the graph, even though it's very economic. So Chairperson, you should go to say meeting in the economy. What you say is mouthful more than what is here, and that's how graphs are working. So I also wanted to understand the barometer, that because I want to be convinced, I don't want to be a blind lawyer, a supporter or a member or a supporter of this government. I don't want to support it blindly. Where there's constructive criticism, we must be able to take that head on. So I was asking myself, which barometer are we going to use? If we say this administration or this government of the day has failed, compared to which one? It has failed compared to the previous system, apartheid government, or are we comparing to the future, the government in waiting that will come? So we need to be convinced and help each other so that we can be open, you know, assist each other. But that will be done in the interest of South Africans, because we put South Africans before everything. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. Let me also join the colleagues in welcoming the presentation, both from the PBO and FFC. And just to underline what Honourable Masham said, that the two presentations are more to help us to ask proper questions when we interact with the department, with the department in general, perhaps in Treasury in particular. I think that's what it's doing. So some of the issues that they are flagging is for us to follow up on them. I think it has to be, or we spoke about the mandate paper, and I'm sure you then assumed that we are all aware what the mandate paper is. So can you please just share with the honourable members what the mandate paper, and I just wanted to check if it's still being used. And it would be nice to also share the mandate paper with the honourable members. An elephant in the room. There's so much is being said about the budget being contractionary or expansionary. I would like to hear both of you what I'm saying, and obviously they have to support what we are saying. If you are saying it's contractionary, we'll have to say why it's contractionary and what is the effect of engaging on a contractionary budget. And if you are saying it's expansionary, why are you saying that? And I think it talks to also amongst, I think, the demand side type of approach versus the supply side approach to economic problems. In the budget speech and in SONA, agriculture and tourism are two of the sectors that have been identified as having better multiplier outcomes, both in terms of economic growth and employment creation. I would like to hear both of you what you are saying. Are the resources talking to that have been allocated to those two sectors? You made a Herculean statement, I think it was PBO, that governments worldwide now favorably consider fiscal policy to boost the economy, aggregate demand, and so on. So I just wanted to say, yes, the statement is very encouraging, but can you share with us which are those governments, what have they done, and what outcomes are we having coming from them? The incentives, there are so many incentive schemes that we're having, which basically they talk to the supply side of the economy. I just want to hear your view, both of you, as to how effective are they and the outcomes that have we been able to measure the outcomes coming from those incentives. Because what they do, by the way, incentives, they rob the receiver of revenue of the funds with some expectation. Have we been able to measure the success or lack thereof of those incentive schemes? There is in the budget, the minister speaks about some relaxation that I'm not sure that it's individuals or companies who are going to be allowed to be able to take 10 million rand out. I don't know whether if you just go to that section, you'll see that. I'm trying to understand exactly what I'm trying to achieve with that one, the economic rationale behind that one. So both of you could talk into that. You know, one of the things that I always find in our discourse, we talk so much about the creation of jobs, which is a very important element. We need to do that. But I hear us saying very little about the protection of jobs that we're having. Because if the economy is bleeding jobs and we create jobs, it's not a rocket science to say this is a zero-sum game. What can we do to protect the jobs that we're having? I always take the view that it's better to protect what you have than to start something completely new. I'm just saying, have you ever applied your mind to paraphrase government? What is it that we can do, including the incentives, because the incentives that we're having, by and large, are incentives to create jobs. But incentives to keep jobs, I don't think that we've applied our minds on that one. But I just want to hear your educated view when it comes to that. I think I'll stop at that and allow you to see between FFC and PBO who starts, and then let's go. Thanks.
I'm Chair, are you starting with us, or?
I said decide. If you are there, please go.
Okay, if it's okay with colleagues at FFC, I'll start on PBO. So. Thank you for your grace. Honourable members, Chair, I think what I'll deal with are the questions around whether this is an expansionary or contractionary budget, and whether the difference between demand side and supply side, and whether the demand side is going to be stimulated. I would like to start, as many members were raising the issue about the effectivity and follow-up in this committee, that I think it was Honorable Karim, when we did our MTBPS presentation, who suggested that there should be at some point a workshop where National Treasury and PBO discuss fiscal policy with the committees and discuss different approaches and the differences, because we've been bringing this along. And I seem to remember that there was agreement within that meeting. So maybe that's something we can think about and possibly follow up if my recollection is correct. I just want to go back to think about the context for talking about expansion and contraction. And in a lot of the discourse globally, the discussion is about austerity versus expansion. And this is one of the discussions that came up very strongly after the global financial crisis, when a lot of the mainstream thinking was called into question. And there was a move by many governments to, especially in the developed world, but also countries like China and some of the East Asian economies, to stimulate the economies through fiscal stimulus. And this very quickly shifted, because they started realizing that they had overestimated how fast the bounce back from the crisis would be. But also they started noticing that certain countries' debt to GDP levels were increasing, because they weren't, their GDPs were down, but they were stimulating the economies. And in this environment, in 2010, there was an economist called Alberto Alessina, who came up, a very mainstream economist, who came up with this notion that you could actually have contraction and expansion. And this became the basis for thinking about fiscal consolidation. The other factor that supported the move towards fiscal consolidation was the sovereign debt crisis, especially in Greece. And many countries that had actually ended up bailing out their banks and private sectors ended up having larger government deficits. And there was a real concern about paying that. And when this economist, supply-side economist, came up with this notion that you could actually contract your government spending and so support expansion, that seemed to be a favorable idea. And this idea was that basically you by government stepping outside of the picture, they stop crowding out the private sector, and it promotes more confidence for the private sector to come in and step in and invest more. The period since then has shown that this idea is very wrong, but also the theoretical and statistical basis for this idea, the modeling used to show, to make these points, were actually counted, and including by the IMF in an IMF working paper, to show that there have been mistakes made in certain periods that were deemed to be contractionary were actually expansionary in certain countries, etc. I won't go into detail too much. I know we have limited time and the SSC is for us to come. But what I'm saying is that the thinking, the macroeconomic thinking, the perspective that has informed the kind of policies that we have followed, that we're following, and this has been widespread adopted in other countries, and to move towards fiscal consolidation and in some cases austerity, comes from a certain economic perspective that doesn't seem to me to be intellectually or empirically that sound. And there's been a huge push for expansion. The other side of the supply side economics is that for a long time, especially since the late 60s, early 70s with Milton Friedman and the Monetarist Revolution, that there was a push to say that the only thing that government can do is monetary policy, and that monetary policy should be put into an independent central bank so that government doesn't actually mess around with it, and that fiscal policy is ineffective. And this actually also became one of the trademarks in the way in which other countries and South Africa responded in the period from, especially after 2010, but especially after 2012, 2013, with a broad or widespread adoption of fiscal consolidation. And basically, we saw the countries that could afford it move towards quantitative easing and other what we call unorthodox monetary policy, basically putting the recovery into the hands of central banks. Today, when I say that there's widespread acceptance that fiscal policy should be used, is because by at least 3 years ago, the realization that monetary policy has reached its limits and can't actually get you out of this, and a questioning of the actual independence of central banks and the need to actually have effective fiscal policy, and that fiscal policy can be effective, has actually entered into the debate, and is what I call a new mainstream consensus on that. And so the fact that you've got very low or negative, zero or negative interest rates in many countries shows that the limits of monetary policy to stimulate economies and expand economies out of this thing. And basically, central banks are saying to the world, you need to start looking at fiscal policy, which then raises how do you coordinate fiscal and monetary policy, especially when you sanctified to some extent the independence of central banks. So we at the point now where this is actually a major discussion in the election campaigns and in the way going forward. We saw in the recent English elections that there was a strong push on. And to some extent an agreement on both sides that there should be increased spending in Britain, even though Britain's debt-to-GDP ratio is higher than South Africa, probably about the last I looked was over 90%. We see in the US certain candidates on the Democratic side, especially the more left and liberal ones, pushing for huge increases, but also we see that Donald Trump's tax cuts provided a huge fiscal stimulus, and the U.S. economy has actually created jobs, unemployment's come down, but they haven't gotten the levels of investment that they want, and so there's a push for saying tax cuts aren't the best way to do it. Maybe it should be government spending and government grants and transfers. Germany, and this is actually in other parts of Europe as well, but particularly in Germany, we've seen the European economy doing very poorly. There's now a discussion from Germany described as an ordo-liberal country, a country that actually for a very long time was hugely phobic about running deficits. And now looking around them at the conditions in the world, looking at the state of the infrastructure, saying basically we need to actually take on debt. We need to move away from this. And in fact, since they've been doing this for such a long time, they're struggling to move away from surpluses and to planning and spending adequately. In the developing world, we've seen, especially in China and India before the coronavirus, with China, real concerns, and China actually boosting again on the monetary side, but also direct investment in the Chinese economy, and the Indians now having very poor performance. And the debate from the opposition is that there needs to be a fiscal stimulus, but the Indian Indian government not necessarily adopting that position. So we haven't seen the real implementation of these policies, but it's very much part of a global discussion about that. Now, in terms of the South African debate and this budget, is this a contractionary or expansionary budget? I think there is an acknowledgement in the budget review that the spending cuts proposed will have some negative effects, but there also are some offsetting factors to that. The other side of that is that the supply side measures, the sectoral interventions that Treasury is talking about are ones where they're actually hoping that government intervention won't be that expensive, what we argue is that they're too focused on that side, and that's not going to give us the results we expect if we don't have the demand side improving and coming up. So from our perspective, we've shown, I think, and we mentioned over several years in our MTKPS and our budget, because we've made the comment that fiscal consolidation has been a drag on growth in South Africa, that it does have a contractionary impact. And now that we've seen it happening over long periods of time, I think we need to start looking at what has the impact been on the actual capital stock and the growth part of the economy, because over time, those are affected, and the way in which businesses react. And for me, the question isn't necessarily, for instance, the confidence of households when it comes to expenditures, about the affordability. And as FSC has shown, is that people are in a precarious position, and people are chronically poor, and poor make up the majority of our populations. And so, you know, they would be very confident if they had money in their pockets to spend, but they don't. In terms of investment, I think that's a much bigger discussion, and we need to look at global trends, what has happened to global corporate restructure. Now, South African large corporations particularly have moved into the global arena, but not necessarily invested much into the productive sector in South Africa, and that a lot of the activity that has been happening in the financial sphere in terms of moving paper and rather than long-term productive investment. So I've taken a long time, but I felt that given the interest, that it's necessary to go into that. I'm going to immediately hand over to
Thank you, Suraj. Thank you, Chair. Quite a lot of questions. I'll try to lump some of them together, and my colleagues will come in. Chair, you know, during our pre-MTPS pre-budget briefing last week, we shared a story about a local business woman who was concerned, who was in the tourism industry, and she was concerned that the new business models, which are based on, largely reliant on technology and so on, are quickly taking away the businesses, local businesses, which, you know, raise the issue, that's how we introduce the discussion about digital economy. And I think the point there was to say the issue around taxation of digital economy, it's a global rethinking in terms of how we should tax multilateral enterprises or your MNEs. So there's so much thinking in terms of how is the current taxing system or corporate tax model still relevant, considering that it was conceptualized during the India, you know, League of Nations way, way back before even the World War One, and even then, it was mainly about protecting certain jurisdiction interests over the others and so on. So I think the thinking is more about how do we reform it to ensure that each and every jurisdiction get a fair share of tax and rights over the profit and income being realized. But more so that one of the main principles that was used before, Chair, to assess whether where we tax this profit was fiscal present test, whereby you need to make sure that to check whether where was this business having any presence in South Africa before we can test it. But now we realize that the way as the new models come, which are reliant on technology, that doesn't work anymore. You know, business can just be in far, jurisdictions, and yet still be able to make money in other jurisdictions, and that money gets eroded tax bases in those jurisdictions. So I think the discussion is largely to say, how are we faring in terms of reforming the taxing? Because I mean, the discussion globally is that probably we need to start seeing a multinational entity as a one entity globally, and decide to say, and then we'll decide where has been large proportion of its revenue realized, and reallocate that profit based on that. And you realize that many developing countries are actually, that's going to be a good model, because most of these MNEs are eroding our tax bases using different mechanisms. We're not able to close on that gap. I think that's where the point is, Che, in terms of how taxation of digitalized economy. It's not large about imposing models, but to say, is the system currently fair? And that's where the discussion is. And it's certainly, there's a quite consensus globally, even the advanced countries that we've seen in the same times, France fighting with the US in terms of imposing 3% over the revenue generated by big multinational technology companies and so on. So there's a quiet realization, though, that actually the way the tax system works, it doesn't necessarily address the concerns of generating more revenue. More so that when you realize developing countries are largely reliant on income tax than the advanced countries. So if you take away that tax base, you are denying developing countries potential of realizing their objectives, you know, social economic objectives, because they are unable to get more taxes in these multilateral corporations. We can still discuss it later, Honourable Member, and just provide more clarity in this regard. And I think there wasn't really a tax deduction in the proposal. It was just to, I like how a colleague from PVC mentioned, to ensure that the tax liability or the disposable income of taxpayers remain the same by adjusting the tax brackets for inflation. There wasn't necessarily a tax deduction in that regard. Just to answer in that specific point, the employment incentives, tax incentives, it's a big point that what we've been saying over the years, you know, that the question is not much of do we have enough incentives or which incentives we have, but I think the question has always been how effective are these incentives to realize the objectives. And I think the point that we noted also in the 3 years here, so look, an example, an employment incentives was introduced, ETI, employment tax incentives were introduced earlier years to try to incentivize business from employing younger labor force in the economy. And one of the questions that came up after this was, you said, look, maybe this mechanism is more concentrated than you want it to be, you need to reform it and make sure it realizes its objectives. But I think that the point has always been, you know, governments or the legislature would require government to give some sense of feedback in terms of whether has it been, has these incentives enabled government to realize the objectives of growing businesses, more so that we've seen more of some of these incentives being extended to various specific sectors and so on. But I think what we've seen in this budget is government committing that they will provide that review in terms of which incentives need to be taken away or which incentives need to be given back. But I think there has been a lot of discussion to say, look, you've seen some of the investments in particular sectors because of, when you take mining, for example, I mean, I spoke about effective tax rates. You take mining, for example, mining sector is probably the sector that is paying far much low effective tax rate because of some of the specific accelerated depreciation on assets. Find that they pay 5%. The effective tax rate in the sector is 5% as opposed to 28%. So it's an issue of realizing how that incentive has made it sure it retains the jobs that you wanted to retain, or you create more jobs, as largely the objective is to create jobs, grow economy, and to deal with social economic challenges in that regard.
Just a second, you have got 10 minutes to finish so that they've got their 30 minutes to run.
All right, okay, I think let me just close by saying one point. I think which relates to a couple of issues raised by various other members, and I'll give it to Nelia. Money bills. I think money bills is a powerful legislation which empowers the legislature to, extend oversight over the executive. And I think answering the questions by Honourable Peters and Honourable Members who were raising whether the committee is ineffective or not, and a BRRR, it is one of the tools that is used by Parliament, should be used by parliamentary oversight over legislation. And I think one of the big questions, I think, which we've discussed sometime back in the office, is that how far has been the follow through from the legislation oversight? And I think that's probably one area we want to discuss. Thank you.
Thank you, Jimmy. Honourable Member, the medium-term strategic framework for the next 5 years, we haven't seen that, but we've spoken to colleagues in the DPME, and the new MTSF will take on a total new structure. They won't focus on the 14 outcomes per se, but they will rather focus on the seven priorities indicated by the President. That's all that we know, but it is important that we get that document, because in the PBO we normally also analyse the document and see how budgets are linked to that. In terms of the expenditure trends and whether PBO has done more research. We haven't done more research on the wage bill, but last year there was a recommendation from the Standing Committee on Appropriations, and they asked the National Treasury and Labour to do extensive research on the wage bill. And what they also asked for is to get the exact impact of the aggregate wage in government, the impact of the reducing the public service wage bill, the effect on tax revenue, unemployment, service delivery, and skills leakages. So some of the information has already been included in the 2019 NCBBS, but Treasury also indicated that they will report to the committee before the 2020 NCBPS. So this is only by October 2020. And then in terms of the spending, taking money from the wage bill for SOCs, that we can't say because the reductions were 261 billion, of which only 60 has been reallocated. So whether it comes from programs or from the wage bill, that we can't tell from the budget information. In terms of non-spending, Honourable Member, the non-spending will only realise for 2019-20 at the end of the year. Either the non-spending will be surrendered to the revenue fund, or if it's committed, it will be reallocated during the adjusted budget. And during the adjusted budget, there's also always savings of the first 6 months of the 2020 budget that can be reallocated again in the adjusted budget. There was another question on expenditure. Some of the expenditure that has been reduced was based on slow performance, especially on the grants. That is amongst others. I think other criteria has also applied, such as whether a grant funds salaries. The mandate paper, the situation of the mandate paper, for the last two budgets, we haven't received a mandate paper to inform the priority of spending, but the mandate paper is now called the Budget Priorities Framework by the National Treasury. It's the same document. So yes, and in the current budget, the Treasury actually indicated in the guidelines that the Budget Priorities Framework is still under review. So we also haven't seen a funding priority paper after or before the NCBBS, for example. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairpersons and honourable members. John, Dr. Brown and Dr. Nguve is also going to help with the response to this. I just wanted to check, Honourable Chairperson, the issue of conditions. I wasn't sure whether the conditions is about that the co-chair raised was whether those conditions was related to the ESCOM bailouts and government guarantees, or were those conditions related to conditional grants in itself. But if it's related to the ESCOM bailouts and other institutional bailouts, clearly the PFMA and what the minister's table is that he will articulate what are those conditions going forward. But there's a gate into that. That on page 85 of the budget review, the Treasury is raising, indicating that the guidelines are, give a sense of what those guidelines are to determine whether borrowing should be allowed or government guarantees. And I think the best thing that could be done is for this committee, for the joint, these committees, differently, independently and together, is to ask for those guidelines. And on the basis of that, you will see through those guidelines whether there are risks associated, and what's the type of risk that's associated to the exposure. I thought that the point that was raised, I got it as number 8, honourable number 8, but as honourable our job is, we're not responding, we're not elected, so we can't say whether government has got a good policy or bad policy. What we can do
is basically saying, here's the effect of this policy. So what we were saying, sketching, that at the consolidated level, the economic and social policy has indeed contributed to better forms of education outcomes. I mean, it's a debatable story, and that's what we showed. The other thing that we showed is there's an increase in life expectancy over the years. For example, in 2002, the male life expectancy was 53.7. So the average that males in South Africa will pass on was at the age of 53.7, right? It's now at 61.5. So those interventions that have been made at the health level, maybe at the food security level, maybe at other assets, it shows. Okay? Then the females were at 58 in 2002. Our female counterparts are now at 67.7. It says something. Something has happened. So, other members must be worried. So males, females live longer than males in South Africa. So that's as a result of the policy interventions that's been made. But there are other policies where there are structural problems, there are financing problems, there are implementation issues. On the issue of the e-tolls, what we're saying, the message that we brought is that the policy uncertainties are not only because of government, but it's also because of what's happening outside of government, non-state actors. Policies get challenged in the court. There's social mobilizations that are happening in political parties within government. There's a tension in Gauteng between the national government and the Gauteng government around the e-tolls. And the e-tolls is a revenue-raised government guarantee. So that's the arrangement that when the revenue gets raised, immediately can pay off on that. So those in itself create tensions in the system. So we're saying to the House that be cautious if you talk about policies uncertainties. It cuts both ways. It cuts both within the state in terms of government and outside the state. The point I've been making about the public sector wage bill is simply that, and I sat on the Presidential Public Wage Commission, chaired by a judge, and there are lots of complications within it. But the point that we're making is that should the public sector and the public service be the only ones that takes the brunt? That's the key point that we're making, and shouldn't that be shared in terms of the whole notion of social solidarity across the system? Hence, I raised the point in the beginning that we are at the gridlock between the state, market industry, society, and citizens, and we need to find ways to get out of that gridlock, to be able to push, to see exactly where are the impediments and where are the facilitators. The other point I thought is important to raise is that the question is this budget to deal with the debt? Is this budget to deal with cutting on services? We are in trouble. It's no way, it doesn't matter how we look at it. I mean, the latest report is that we're probably in a recession. I don't know whether it's technical this time around, but we're in trouble. So the budget on the one hand tries to create fiscal stability. On the other hand, it shifts resources around to be able to deal with ensuring that we carry on with the expenditure levels on and it searches for efficiencies. The other issue that deals with the whole question of inequality, surely there are issues of assets that our citizens and households, it's income assets, it's fixed assets, the land issue comes into that play, and obviously we have, like the PBO indicated to us altogether the last time, that we have unemployment, and it's no longer a small number. We talk about mass unemployment for the last couple of years. So how are we going to fix that? And the chairperson is right. We need to talk about employment as opposed to unemployment to that particular question. I think many of the members probably have picked up how that those digital economies, they domicile in South Africa, but they operate in South Africa. What is the returns for us for them operating within the country? You see what the OECD has done to Facebook. and what the UK government is also going to do to Facebook and Amazon to tax them. We're saying simply that we need to explore that as a new space for increasing the fiscus. That's all that we're saying. We don't have the answers to how it should be done or what the compounding effect is going to be, but it's clearly an area that we need to look at. On the question of whether it's the citizens to civil servants, no, we don't know that. But here's the issue that I continuously raise. We need to first sort out the size and the shape of the public service. We need to know how many staff do we need, how do we organize the public service, how do we organize those functions, and how many staff do we need in a particular administration so that we can get those functions productive. That's the first set of issues that we need to resolve. But here's the thing that we sometimes forget. In 1994, we had a hodgepodge of putting a public administration together so that we can deal with the potential instability that we're facing in the country. So what if you look at the complexion of the public service relative to the private sector, it says to you there's a democratic issue you're going to have to address. Because the majority of people that work in the public service are black. So how do we deal with that as the one form of employment relative to what's happening in the private sector? That's why when we talk about the restructuring of the market economy, the restructuring of the public sector, we are also talking about the race questions within all those industries. So we need to think a little bit harder about that. I don't know what the RAS mortality is, but all I can say is that those political avenues are believed to you. You're the elected representatives of the people, so you need to look at oversight and accountability. We can just give you the information around that. On the responses to the FSC, it's hard to tell because, again, the Treasury responded in a particular way. But what we forget is that the recommendation is not made to the Treasury. The recommendation is made to the whole of government. So we are recommending to the provinces, and the provinces also ignores. And when you get to the provinces, they ask you, what's the impact of our recommendation? Then you say, but have you discussed it? Have you approved it? Have you looked at the proportionality of which recommendations are you accepting that the FSC is giving you, and which ones don't you accept? So engaging with the Treasury on which recommendations they're accepting is quite difficult if we don't have Parliament also helping us to say, we agree with the recommendations. Because what we do, Honourable Chairs, is that we present to the two committees, and that's it. And it's over, and we don't know what your views are also about our recommendations. And maybe we should start thinking about installing a particular mechanism as to how do we know that you agree to our recommendations or not. So then we can pursue it. It's the same point I've made last year in the 9 provinces because everybody asked about the impact of the FOC recommendations. Are you feeling better? The economy is not making any one of us feel better, so I'm not so sure how much I respond to the division of revenue recommendations that we've made. Chair, I think I would like our team to respond to the whole question quickly on conditional grants. I'd like firstly John and Kay to respond on the whole question of the protection of jobs. We'll come back to you when we get the chance tomorrow again to talk to some of the, if some things fall out through the cracks, we will pick up on that. The relaxation of taxation to companies, the 10 million question, we're only now looking at what are those taxing proposals that's been made. So hopefully we will, over time, be able to look at that. On the agriculture issue and the agriculture issue and the multiplier effect to the economy, I think that in itself requires quite a conversation because agriculture used to be quite a significant contributor to the GDP. But there's been a decline. But it's also been the emergence of black emerging farmers within that space. And we've got information that will give, we're putting together the papers that will give further information as to what is actually happening to our black emerging farmers. It's not the stories that we hear that our people are not skilled. It's other resources that our people don't have to be able to take active roles in this. So John, and then Kane, and then Kolo.
Thanks, Chase. Thanks, members. There are some wonderful questions here that we can talk about for quite a long time. I think the most difficult one is not the one of why are we the most unequal society in the world. I'm a student of the late Sambita Blanche, you know, and he always had a quote from Jan van Riebeek, where Jan van Riebeek said, "We came here with the guns, and we had the guns, and we took the land, and now it's ours," you know. So a small group came with the biggest guns, and they took the most and kept it, and that is why we are such an unequal society. You know, so the question is, and then there's the other tempting question then, what are we doing right? Oh, what are other countries doing right? And, I mean, that is, of course, the whole of development economics and a lot of other things. And, I mean, there's lots of technique there. People have helped certain economic policies and so on. But I think also at the bottom of that, societies that are successful have dealt with a conflict between the different groups. You know, and our Southeast Asian countries, they had a people talk about the developmental state, but the developmental state was often built on a consensus in the society because there was a lot more equality and joint purpose in those countries. So this is, of course, a very debatable point. What do those others do right? But I think it is this thing that we focus on about the conflict in society. If you've got this amount of conflict in a society because there are different interests, there are problems. And, you know, so I think it is in line with our presentation that one must try and deal with this conflict. Where does it really come from? And that comes back to the whole thing of inequality. I think of a lot of people sort of talked about there was a mention of, do we see the pain of the people? What are the barometers we use? And I think, you know, this barometer that we use here, and this is from the National Income Dynamics Study, the poverty, I mean, that shows pain. 62% up to 65% of people we can classify as poor. 42% of people in 2010, 25% in 2017 are food poor. Does that mean they can't buy enough food for them and their kids and still have something left? So that is pain. Those figures don't say things are going well in this country. It says there's a lot of pain. But what we want to focus on that we think it has gotten better. The best measurements we have from our best universities and our best researchers say the situation has been improving. So we don't share the view that everything is falling apart. You know, certainly there are a lot of things that are not right for South Africa. There's a lot of good, but we think if we look at these things, certain things have been improving, and if we recognize that, we know we are on a path that we can make stronger. So I think, you know, the one member talk about people scavenging on landfill sites, you know. And that is not a good thing. We all don't like it, but at least what we've seen in the past, some of our richest industrialists in Johannesburg have started as people who worked with waste in the port of Durban. So we must also see that a lot of the activity we see that we think we don't want to do that, we can't do that, that looks bad. There's also people, South Africans, being asked to make a living for themselves. And we should be thinking, how do we make it better for them? But we shouldn't just see it as this country is going to the dogs. It's also signs of people making headway. So I think, you know, in that sense, we think we should also focus on the other barometers. There are lots of things that don't look good. But there are also things that have been going better. Then I think the second set of questions was a lot about expansionary or contractionary, you know, the demand side. Do we focus too much on growth and too much on debt? And members might have seen this. The late Professor Terok started this journal, and Professor Plaikis passed it on to us. And two of the former heads of the budget office wrote in there. The one, Ben, I do. Now at the Reserve Bank, and he said there basically, look, at the Reserve Bank we are the goalies. If the country is not scoring a goal, don't blame us. You know, it's the strikers, it's the microeconomic policy, DPR. The same version also Michael Sachs said, you know, fiscal policy can't fix things. We've got to focus on the macroeconomic policy. What's actually going on in South Africa, the politics is the problem. And some of our team thinks that is also, is this different? Everybody's got to play their role, but I think at this stage it's very difficult, I think, to stimulate demand strongly through the budget. But I think there is the point that comes through also from the PBO, that at certain times we made conservative fiscal and monetary choices that cost us dearly. When we should have invested, we cut back. We did tax rate reductions and so on. So at this stage, you know, from the FFC side, we've got to turn around this fiscal situation. But that is not to say that sort of choices of the past have always been right. So I think on the specific question, the chair asked, very specific, is this expansionary or contractionary? It is at best neutral. Real spending is overall, I think, growing at 0.5%.
That's the safest answer, eh?
So that's where I end, I think, on that demand supply side thing. I think another set of questions related to the issue of trusts, I don't find those ones now. But, you know, it's this trust deficit, and we must have more deadlines for government and so on. My sense, being a bureaucrat now for almost, well, it's 21 years, you know, is those deadlines and those priorities and the regulations are just getting more and more. And in the UK Health Service, they talk about a priority thicket between which the health workers get lost. Everybody says, measure this, report to me on that, do that. So it is at this stage my sense that it is difficult for civil servants to manage with everybody that wants to manage them. I think the Treasury is saying now we're not only going to have an ombud for SARS, we're also going to have an inspector general. So I've got sympathy with the commissioner of SARS. But so I think what we're trying to say here is that this trust problem will be breached in a different way, that we must acknowledge the real conflicts that lead to these gridlocks, as Professor Pike called it, and start dealing with them and start negotiating with the groups who are causing the gridlock and say, you want this, they want this, that's why we cannot move on e-tolls and the funding of our roads. The result of that is that our provincial roads also can't move because now the Treasury's got to go and find money for SANRAL because SANRAL cannot get any bills. That was the question on that. And I think those are the three issues. I think on the digital taxes, Professor Flagg, it's nothing about being punitive, but it's people who make money in our country using our infrastructure must also contribute to that. And it's just to get a fair distribution of that burden. And I think what digital economy is one thing, but as we've got all this technological change, there are more things like that happening where there are new ways of making money, and those people must also pay their share of the taxes.
Good afternoon, I'm sure it is by now, Honourable Members and Honourable Chair. I'm not going to add too much because I think we've said a lot already. I just wanted to make reference to, again, the issue about fiscal policy vis-a-vis monetary policy and expansionary vis-a-vis contractionary. I think the debate is framed by Siraj when he gave us sort of historically the movement of emphasis between monetary and fiscal policy is characterized as such, but he ends by saying we need to use fiscal policy and that also there's been an acknowledgement in some countries that government must step out and then leave some space. And I think in the beginning of our presentation, John said, you know, sometimes people just say it's about economic stupid, but actually economics is about people. And I think if we want to use fiscal policy properly, I think what we're saying is that we mustn't assume then that if government steps out, automatically business will step in or automatically people will be entrepreneurial and find ways of employing themselves. that there needs to be a broader discussion amongst all stakeholders. Our chairperson spoke about the size and shape of government. Yes, we need to look at the size and shape of government, but I think we're also saying we need to look at what are the roles of the other relative and respective stakeholders. I think who the winners are and who the losers are matters in terms of how we then can have the conversation going forward, and that's certainly what the commissioners have been applying their minds to as well. We talk about fiscal stimulus, but in this country, I think we said we didn't get everything right. We've had two stimulus packages that were actually very small relative to the size of the budget. We're not quite sure about the impact of them. In fact, Honourable Chair Buthelezi has raised the question around, for example, the employment incentives and even other incentives. And do we even know to what extent they work? And part of the problem, I think, here is about barometers and measurements, because do we know whether or not business was going to hire more people anyway and then just use the incentive as a sweetener, or whether it really did incentivize them to create employment numbers when they've reported such. So I think as a commission, what we're saying is that we really do want to focus on building the human capital and the assets of the country and looking future forward. If we want to say whether or not we have an expansionary or contractionary fiscal policy, I think the numbers, the economic stupid, show that we still have expansionary policy. We're still expanding in terms of numbers. But perhaps what we're saying is that in terms of our vision for the future and what our fiscal position can be in the future, perhaps we are being too conservative and contractionary. Also to say that, and I think this was the issue raised sharply as well, is to say that this means dealing with conflict. It's not going to be easy, but it's the older generation in this country we need to do that. And Dumisani from the CDO also raised the issue when he was making the example of the woman with the small business, about, you know, there are real challenges that people face, and we need to understand what that is, and we need to understand how we unlock the conflicts within the economy, political conflicts and other conflicts. I'm going to leave it there. I think our chairperson spoke to impediments and facilitators, and I think we really, really do need to focus on that.
Thanks, Chair. I'll answer the last question, which was on the reductions on baseline grants, where they target grants which were not performing well in terms of spending. The answer to that question is yes on certain grants and no on certain grants. First, the criteria which was used to reduce the baseline of some grants is past performance, which includes spending or underspending, the growth rate in the previous years. If the growth rate was very high, then these grants were a target. Then if we look at the grants, we find that there are some grants which were performing, which were not spending. For example, the Integrated National Electricity Program grant, the spending in 2018-19 was around 60%. And if you look at over the MTF, about 1.2 billion, that grant would be, baseline would be reduced by 1.2 billion. I think the Honourable Member also spoke about that. It will affect the electrification program, especially in rural areas. So that grant was spending was about 60%. But there are some grants which were spending very well, which were also...
Sorry, Chair.
...which were also targeted.
Can the speaker just respect his own comments and talk into the microphone, please?
Yeah, there were grants which were spending very well but were also targeted. For example, the MIG, which was almost 92%, USDG about 100%, they were also targeted. The Commission raises one concern, though, that some of these grants which were targeted are those infrastructure grants which we raised even in the previous years. And this will affect the
creation of assets in the country as we move on. So that's the only concern we have about this particular grant. But the answer is yes and no. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think during the response, I rushed quickly through, you know, money bills. I think Honorable Peters and Honorable Masangu and Honorable Koman raised an issue around money bills. I wanted to clarify that in terms of the money bills, like, the Minister of Finance has to respond to the budget review recommendation report. So he does that on Annex A of the budget review. He responds. I think what I wanted to say is that the issues are followed through by the committee to say, What is the issue to raise, and what's the next step from the committee side? Thank you.
Thank you so much. Just a few comments before we rise. I think I just wanted to follow up on the conflict that we are having. That is one of the disincentives to investment and economic growth and so on and so forth. And I think I would agree, because as you know, that emanates from inequality, right? And it's something we should take a stand against. It's known that the unstable and unequal societies are the most unstable societies in the world, and no investment want to go to an unstable destination. So I think there is an economic rationale that why we should take a stand against inequality. Politically is correct, but there's even an economic rationale if you wanted not to be political to do that. And that stand, we'll have to take it in action, not just in words. I don't know, there's a video which is circulating of two teams in Germany, which you know, there was one of the players was this man sounds like a racist from the stand. It was Hoffenheim FC and Bayern Munich, and that black player decided to leave, and the whole 22 players they asked him to come back, and he came back, and they decided that they were going to pass each other. 22 of them, they started passing each other football as a whole protest to say that this thing doesn't serve us. So I'm saying, when we take action against inequality and some of these ills in society, they have got more impact if we act rather than us coming out with on this slogan. I think Prof, I've also read the thing of a recession, which means two successive quarters where we had a negative economic growth in South Africa. The third and the last quarter of 2019, I think the figures which have just come out say that they've We are in a recession, which then says that the growth story should be a real story between and among us. That how do we jumpstart the economy? This may be a proof that some of our policies are not working. Obviously, the question of ESCOM is a factor, but this is not a univariate equation. There are many other factors, because what we usually do, one can say, I think that once we solve ESCOM, all our problems are solved. The time when ESCOM was functioning and we did go to recession, so we should be looking at all these things that may be contributing to that. And let's also agree that there are areas that we all agree, irrespective of what political persuasion we're coming from. The question of departments not spending money with all these problems, right? And it has got a direct impact. For instance, even the recession that we're having, if you don't spend money, we are robbing the economy of the money that it needs, right? We are robbing the economy of the jobs that they need, and we are also robbing such of the revenues that they might have collected. So I think such things, and I'm sure we can identify a number of other things where we really must focus on and make sure that as we play oversight responsibility, we try and improve and see some improvement and measure that improvement. Something that is always nice to talk about, I think it's a big work and so on, but I don't see that government is moving on. The question of BEPS and illicit financial flows, base erosion and profit shifting. There's so much leakages in the South African economy as far as revenues are concerned. But again, I don't think that we are real. I think we, as we play our side fashion, is one thing that I would like FFC and PPO to help us and see how can we, as these committees, play our role and make sure that at least there's some progress as far as that is concerned. Because it's billions and billions, right? They say sometimes we find ourselves chasing lizards while the crocodiles are looking at us. And the financial flows are a big thing, and we seem not to be having our grasp on them. But I think I would like to thank FFC and BPO and thank you, honorable members. Thank our visitors from the committee.